Lecture 4, The Good Life and the Role of Reason.
In the last lecture, we ended by talking a bit about how Kant thought our mental faculties work and how it is that he thought that knowledge is always something that is dependent on our faculties. As he saw it, it wasn't just that we took in the world by means of our senses and just let the senses work on us. Instead, our minds actively produced a format that allowed us to make sense of things. And this he attempted to analyze in really quite great detail. The way he talked about our faculties was to talk about certain basic shapes that any knowledge we have basically takes. And one of these shapes was causality. Causality had been already a matter of debate for a while in Western thought, particularly because David Hume, one of the British empiricists, had argued that causality really isn't a very sound principle. It's something that we need to make sense of things, that we always tend to think that one thing causes another. But in fact, this really isn't a very well-grounded belief. It's just something that's habitual. We've had enough experience where one thing happens and a certain kind of consequence follows, as we would say it, that we tend to think that the first thing causes the second thing. But that maybe isn't exactly how it works. Kant didn't particularly like the skeptical ring of that. Hume, in fact, was one of the people that got him started thinking about some of these matters. But he did think that there was something about causality that most people didn't recognize, namely that causality was one of those shaping factors that our minds impose on things. Indeed, it is a fact that we don't have absolute knowledge or really any knowledge of the way the world is independent of the way our minds take it in. But our minds have to organize things in terms of causality. And in a way, this is very lucky for us. Because we do organize what we take in by means of causality, we're able to practice certain kinds of disciplines that we do. And probably most dramatically in Kant's time, this discipline that did a lot of that was the discipline of science. I should say here that natural science struck Kant as, in a way, a problem and in a way a wonderful advantage of his own time. It was pretty clear to him that the investigation that scientists undertook of the world produced a lot of fascinating information that we could all gain from and do certain things with. But he was rather worried about the danger that he saw in science, that too much of scientific description of the way the world is might lead people to misunderstand their own nature. So in a way, once again, we're talking about the nature of the self here. What Kant feared most of all was that by getting in the habit of looking at the world scientifically, by conducting experiments, seeing what the regular responses to certain kinds of techniques would be, and believing that from that we could conclude certain regularities in nature, even come up with laws of nature, Kant feared that we might think that this would also apply to human beings. And certainly some people have tried to do exactly what Kant feared they would, have tried to figure out how do human beings behave in certain kinds of cases. Indeed, psychology today involves a lot of this kind of study. Now, why did Kant think this was a problem? Well, he thought that if we could describe human beings as regularly reacting in certain predictable ways to certain kinds of stimuli, the suggestion would be that human beings aren't free at all. If this is regular, if this automatically happens, it seems that our whole moral nature is bypassed. And the more people come to believe that there are natural laws about what human beings are like, the less seriously they're going to take morality. Now, Kant was an intellectual, probably more than an intellectual. I'll make an aside here because I think it will help to understand the material. One of the best lines, I think, in Friedrich Nietzsche, a philosopher of the 19th century, was about Kant. His claim about Kant was that Kant had a joke. Kant basically wanted to defend the views of the common man, but in language no common man could possibly understand. Kant invented a lot of his own language. What we'll see, I hope, as we proceed in this lecture, is that Kant's views about morality really do have a lot of roots in common sense. His views are not that dissimilar, probably, from many that we have even before we start thinking philosophically or with a lot of focus. Nevertheless, his explanation is very complex and involves the introduction of a lot of very complex terms, such as noumenal, phenomenal. Bear in mind, even though this might be a bit of a burden, that the aim is still to show why something as commonsensical as the idea that people do in some ways act freely, to try to defend that. So even though Kant is difficult, notoriously difficult to read and interpret, nevertheless, his aim is really to point out that what a lot of us take for granted is actually very well grounded. So back to the phenomenal world, causality, and science. Kant's concerned that we need to recognize where morality fits in our account of the world in order to maintain any kind of commitment to it. And he's both a religious and a highly moral person and thinks that's a very important thing to do. So how do we figure this out? Well, he says, let's start by considering what it is that we can explain in terms of causality with respect to human beings. One of the kinds of things I can explain are the fact that I'm motivated by certain things in my environment. Suppose I'm very hungry. I walk into a restaurant and see that some people at a table not very far from me have just been served a bunch of beautiful food. What do I do? Well, my instinct or my desire might be to run over, grab the food for myself, and take it to my own table. But I don't do that. Why don't I do that? Because, in fact, I'm not completely dictated to by the fact that the natural world motivates me in these ways. Kant calls our reaction to causal pressures in the natural world inclinations. Yes, if I'm hungry and smell and see food that seems really attractively prepared, I'm going to want it. But I have control over myself and am able to resist that desire. Were I simply a cog in a kind of machine of causality, then these kind of causal influences on me would absolutely determine what I do. I'd step into a room, see food, know I wanted it, go grab it. But I don't have to do that. Why? Because there's more to me than just my existence in this causal network that we see in the phenomenal world. Now, that's interesting because everything that Kant says we do see and know in the everyday world is, in fact, controlled by causality. We can only understand it in terms of causality. So if I'm going to understand my own moral behavior, I might start looking around for some counter cause. I might look to some other pressure. I mean, maybe the waiter looks like he's going to intercept my attempt to grab the food. But most of the time, we don't really see anything like that, countervening the desire to go take the food away from these other people. So what is it that interferes in this case? What Kant would say steps in and intervenes is actually our true selves. Our true selves are not simply phenomenal. Our true selves, therefore, are not part of the world of everyday experience or knowledge. Nevertheless, by virtue of the fact that we can act morally, we can choose not to act on inclination when we feel that there's a moral reason not to, because we can do that, we recognize that we aren't purely phenomena. We are also noumenal. Well, so far so good. We've said, after all, that the noumenal world is the world as it is in itself. As it is in itself without our faculties processing it. And certainly I think we all take ourselves to have some reality. So in a way to say that our true selves are noumenal is just to say that our true selves are real. But can we say anything more about our true selves? Let's hope so if we're going to make sense of morality. And Kant says, yes, indeed we can. Our true selves are the selves that we experience through our will. He talks about goodwill. And I think this is a very good illustration of exactly where he thinks morality lies. One of his claims is that the only thing that is good without any qualification is a goodwill. Okay, what is a goodwill? Well, if you think of Christmas cards that encourage goodwill, what are they encouraging? They're encouraging people to behave not out of any ulterior motivation, but just out of a desire to be kind, to be generous, to be loving, not aiming to get anything out of anyone, but just freely out of a spirit of goodness. In a sense, this summarizes Kant's whole conception of morality, that what morality really is acting out of the right intention. And how do we do that? Well, in fact, the way we do that is we allow our will, our true self, to determine when to act with inclination and when to act against it. We don't have to act on the basis just of pressures that come to us from the outside. Our will legislates. Our will decides, okay, in this case, fine to eat. I'm going to have a similar desire for good, delicious food if, after I've gone into the restaurant, I sit down, order food, and it's brought to the table. Then, presumably, I'm not going to feel, shouldn't do that. I'm going to feel quite comfortable about taking the first bite and how delightful it will be. In that case, what's going on is my will has looked at the situation and said, fine, this is an appropriate way to accommodate your appetites and your needs, your inclinations. But there are some that are not appropriate. So what we need to do is figure out what's right and what's wrong. What Kant's trying to do here is to defend the idea that human beings are free. We are not simply subject to causal pressures from the outside, although as physical beings we experience them, but we have freedom by virtue of our will. And that's what is really crucial. Now for Kant, trying to figure out what the difference is between acceptable behavior and unacceptable behavior is a matter of reason. In fact, his view is that this being that we truly are, the reality that we are noumenally, is fundamentally rational. Reason is a faculty that we have and a faculty that enables us to transcend everyday experience. Sometimes I have a really good idea about what I ought to do, even though I've never seen anyone do something quite like that before. Or maybe I see a lot of people really setting fairly bad examples. Kant, in his own way, and many aside, suggests that he's seen a lot of people that are pretty far from good moral examples. But nevertheless, I don't have to rely on just what examples I've seen around me. Even if everyone else were cheating on their taxes, I wouldn't have to. And why is that? Well, first of all, that inclinations don't dictate what we do, but also we have a faculty of reason that allows us to think beyond what we've actually experienced. We don't have to have a role model for absolutely everything we do. In fact, in many cases, we don't have that at all. So what does reason tell us with regard to right and wrong? Kant thinks it gives us the key to the good life, and it's a key that is something that we can depend upon across the board. In fact, he uses an expression that is quintessentially Kantian, because it is not obvious what it means, first of all, but is very clear once you understand it, and that expression is the categorical imperative. Okay, slowly we'll take categorical imperative. What does categorical mean? For Kant, it means something that doesn't depend on any motivations a person has, but applies across the board to everybody. You might say across the whole category of human beings, this is something that applies. And what this whole category of human beings for him is a subset of a larger category, the category of rational beings. Now, why does Kant talk about rational beings as opposed to human beings? I think in part because he certainly considers God to be a rational being. He may believe that there are angels and considers them to be rational beings. He actually at one point suggests that even though, of course, no one is in a position in his time and place to know it, there may well be intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. And in a sense, he'd go along with the theory of Star Trek, that one owes a certain obligation to other rational beings if one encounters them, regardless of whether they're like us in other respects. Now, what Kant is saying, and saying that across the category of rational beings, we have a categorical imperative, is to say there's a common moral law that applies to absolutely everybody in this category. In other words, everyone should agree, if they're really rational about it, what right and wrong are. Now, I want to point out that when he says that, he isn't claiming that everybody in the world has come to exactly the same way of spelling out moral rules, although he thinks there's some pretty common patterns that might suggest it. Murder, in general, is frowned on across humanity. There may be occasions where killing is justified, but on the whole, Generally, it isn't. The killing of human beings, at any rate, isn't. And you do need a special justification to say why it might be right in some cases. The fact that this is commonly agreed upon might be evidence that there's something to what Kant's saying. But that's not mainly the evidence he relies on. He doesn't want to just go on the basis of experience in our history and our recognition of what other people do to say this is what right and wrong are. It's not something that experience will tell us. It's something that reason tells us. And it's an imperative because it is a statement of the moral law. Now, when he de-emphasizes particular ways that this has been articulated, he's able to do that because he thinks you can actually summarize the whole moral law in a single statement. What the moral law is an establishment of the dividing line between right and wrong. What's acceptable, what's not acceptable. So if you can just pinpoint where that line is, then whatever you're thinking about doing, it's going to be on one side of the line or the other. You can fine-tune your understanding of certain kind of behaviors on the basis of whether or not it's in the acceptable range or the unacceptable range. Now, when he tries to articulate the entire moral law in a single statement, he actually comes up with several statements. And his claim is all these statements point to exactly the same thing. They're different ways of getting a handle on the division between appropriate and inappropriate. Nevertheless, some people have questioned whether or not these are really equivalent statements. I'll leave you to decide. Although he mentions five different formulations that try to summarize this, I will mention only two. The first, and in a sense most classical perhaps, is the following. Act only on that maxim whereby you can at the same time will that it should become a universal law. I'll read it again. Act only according to that maxim whereby you can at the same time will that it should become a universal law. Okay, let's take that according to the terms he uses. Maxim there is not obvious, although we sometimes say when someone has an old saying that they pass along that that's a maxim. What Kant means by a maxim is a principle that our action that we're thinking about would correspond to. In other words, what he's telling us to do if we're considering whether or not something is right or wrong, well, what principle would cover this? Suppose I'm thinking about lying to someone because I want to get something out of them, maybe just because I'm in a certain kind of mood. What principle am I operating on when I do that? Well, the maxim is something that we come up with on the basis of asking that question. Suppose I want to get some money out of someone. This is one of his own examples. And I tell that person, if you'll loan me some money today, I'll gladly pay you in 2 days when I get paid. But meanwhile, I have no intention of paying the money back. In fact, I intend to skip town precisely with the money that I'm going to borrow. So I never intend to see this person again, and I certainly don't intend to repay the money. Now, is this appropriate or inappropriate? Probably most of us have our intuitions about that already, but Kant is trying to explain why it is that we conclude that this is inappropriate. And what he says, according to this statement of the categorical imperative, is we should only act on that maxim if it's one that I could willingly accept as universal law. In other words, not only is it okay for me to act on that maxim, I should be able to say, sure, there's nothing wrong with that. It would be perfectly all right if everybody operated on this basis. And what do we get when we think about this maxim? Well, we get a world where people are not loaning money so freely. In fact, they're not going to accept any promise at all. Because if everybody operated on the principle that they make a bad promise whenever it's convenient to them, it's not very likely people are going to accept "I promise" as meaning anything at all. At best, it's going to be sort of the punchline to a joke, like, oh, I should loan you the money because you promised to pay it back, right? That's not going to be acceptable. And our own reason recognizes that this would not be a tenable way of operating. In fact, what we're doing in that case, Kant says, is we're actually trying to make a special deal for ourselves, which is typically true when someone contemplates bad behavior. Basically, what we're trying to do is keep the institution of promises going. I mean, we definitely want that to be there because we want to get the money. So we want everyone else to follow the rule of keeping promises so that the person that you're going to unsuspectingly make this bad promise to will believe you, but then do something different yourself. And this is an indication that this is wrong. You've crossed the line into the unacceptable arena of behavior when you've decided to act on a maxim that you wouldn't think would be appropriate for other people to act on. And Kant's claim is that this is the categorical imperative, and whenever we contemplate our action, if we honestly try to come up with what maxim we're operating on here, and we really honestly can say, fine for everyone, then it's acceptable. But as soon as we find out that we want to do something that we wouldn't think is good for other people to act on, in fact, for everybody to act on, then we're thinking about doing something wrong. Another formulation that he thinks comes to the same thing, or draws the same line at least, is the following. Act in such a way that you treat humanity, whether in your own person or in the person of another, always at the same time as an end, and never simply as a means. Again, I'll read this a second time. Act in such a way that you treat humanity, whether in your own person or in the person of another, always at the same time as an end, and never simply as a means. Okay, what does this mean? Kant's view is that there's a big difference between the way we treat things and the way we treat persons. Human beings have a kind of dignity that mere things do not have. Basically using things according to our own desires, assuming that we have a right to do so, is perfectly appropriate. But using human beings just as we want to use them is never appropriate, unless it is conjoined with deep respect for them as human beings. What would be an example? Well, I'll consider first an example of something that he wouldn't view as wrong on this account. Today I took a cab to come here. And in that sense, I depended on a cabbie to drive me here. I was using the cabbie. But I wasn't treating the cabbie as someone without human dignity. I was treating the cabbie as a person that I respected. We discussed how to get here. I was friendly, polite. All of these things are quite compatible with moral behavior. But it's when you view other people as simply a kind of cog in your machine or a means to get what you want, and in effect you'll bypass their own reasoning processes to get what you want or treat them without any respect at all, that you violated the moral law. So let's go back to the promising example. In that case, Kant would say, what's going on here? What does it mean to say that you should not treat the humanity of someone else as a mere means, but only as an end in itself? Well, in this case, what have I done? I've basically sized up the person I want to get the money from and thought, now if I told the truth, this person well might not want to give me the money. After all, the person would have no reason to think that they'd ever see the money again, and they'd only be, in effect, giving me money. So what am I going to do? I'm going to bypass the fact that they ought to have some control in their actions and have enough information to make judgments on their own. I'm basically going to say anything that it takes in order to get the money out of the person. I'm kind of treating the person as something like a machine that I use to get a soda from or a candy bar. I basically plug in the money, get out whatever it was that I wanted. And effectively, that's what I'm doing with my words in this case. I say whatever words it takes. I get the money. I've completely ignored the fact that this is a human being who has reason, who can make judgments, who ought to be allowed to make judgments. And if the person were substituted by a machine that would give me money if I said the same words, same to me. In other words, I've treated this person as just a means. Now, what does it mean to say the person or anyone's humanity is an end in itself? This is, in a way, a kind of strange use of end, I think, for us in our time, but wouldn't have been so at Kant's time. The notion of an end here is a goal, a purpose. And what he's claiming is that anything that is rational has its own goal built into it, that it has its own purpose, that this purpose ought to be valued. So if I value humanity in another person, I'm saying that they are not a mere means, but they themselves have a lot of validity and importance just being the kind of thing that they are. Here, end means something like the end of your endeavor, where it's not just that you've gotten sick and tired and walked away, but you've actually completed something. Human beings have a certain kind of destination or moral vocation because they're rational. And when we try to work around that, we're basically showing contempt for their humanity. Now, Kant thinks we can do this to ourselves as well. He suggests, for example, that someone who is really, really depressed and decides to commit suicide is doing something wrong precisely because they're not respecting their own humanity and their own moral destination. It's kind of an interesting argument. What he's saying is that, well, if we look at both of these different formulations of categorical imperative, we can see it, I think. First of all, let's think about what the maxim would be. I'm very depressed. If I find life not worth living, it's all right to commit suicide, might be the general rule. Well, suppose we make that a general rule for everybody. Would it be appropriate? Would we find it completely acceptable for everyone to operate on that basis? Well, probably not if we want the human species to continue, since probably everyone at one point or another has a moment when they think things really don't seem to be working out, that life is really bad. A very sort of low depressed moment probably occurs to everyone. And if automatically people responded to that by killing themselves, it's not clear that we'd have a human race to flourish. And Kant would view that as completely unacceptable to anybody who's rational at all. With regard to humanity, there's a kind of strange sense in which I'm using my own humanity and using it up in order to end the pain if I commit suicide on this basis. In other words, I feel really down and out, and what I really want is a condition where I'm not in pain anymore, but I'm so eager to get to that goal of no pain that basically throwing away my humanity and throwing away my whole being as an individual is the price I'm willing to pay for it. Well, that, again, doesn't make any sense. In fact, it's because of a certain sense of value to a human being, probably, that we even have a sense that things ought to be going relatively well. So I'm doing something profoundly irrational in acting against the moral law here. I'm basically using up my humanity and throwing it away in order to create a better situation for my own humanity to continue. And that, Kant thinks, is just profoundly contrary to reason. And I think that also points out why it is that he thinks that reason plays such an important role here. What we're really trying to do is get the biggest picture we can of things and say, are these ways of living acceptable if this becomes a system, if this becomes just the way people universally operate? If it is, well and good, but if not, then there's something wrong with the way I'm thinking here. And he thinks our reason is quite able to come to these conclusions so long as we do it sincerely. I mean, of course, Kant is well aware that anyone can kind of tinker around with the way they formulate the maxim to probably come up with something that other people would acceptably behave according to. But nevertheless, it's just silly. I mean, if I encounter a person who really has plenty of money and would like some, they should give it to me. I mean, that doesn't really have anything to do with you at all, but you can always somehow rationalize what it is you want to do. But if you're sincere and really try to think, well, what is the principle I'm operating under here? Then he thinks we'll reach the same conclusions and the right conclusions. Now, interestingly, Kant isn't trying to give us rules for absolutely every occasion. But nevertheless, what he does with the categorical imperative is suggest that it's really rules or principles that are the best way to focus on the moral law. In other words, what is it that we want to do when we think about living well and living properly? Well, we try to figure out what rules we should guide ourselves by and figure out whether the rules that we can think of are rules we'd be happy with other people living with. Even though not everyone agrees with Kant in that Kant is really concerned with intentions and really not very concerned with consequences, nevertheless, there has been a lot of agreement with him that living according to rules is a good way of thinking about morality. So some of his major opponents on the consequences idea, the utilitarians, think it makes perfect sense to look for rules, but their idea is we ought to think in terms of consequences. So their rule is this going to promote the greatest good for the greatest number of people? If so, it's good. If not, it's a bad alternative. And this emphasis on rules has been pretty constant in Western thought over the past couple of centuries and is only now turning a bit toward the direction of thinking about virtues, thinking about character. We'll see that this is true in a number of the other societies that we talk about. Thanks.